The Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 178.
Fresh looks. Why open source matters.
Yeah. And this is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
And Tom Lawrence.
And today, Tom's going to take the reins and talk about why open source matters. And, since he's a business owner and what he deals with.
Yeah, so. I have different perspectives on it. And obviously I'm here because I'm a big advocate of open source. And if it wasn't for the open source movement, we probably wouldn't be here at all.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
The world would look different.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, Tom, why does open source matter?
Why does open source? Well, let's start with where it came from. The great philosopher, Richard Stallman. It all begins with him.
It does.
And I call him philosopher, and I do like this. This is something Linus says he's the philosopher of it, and Linus says he himself is the engineer of a lot of this. And there's a lot of truth to that. So back in 83 is when Stallman started the GNU project, which is, of course, the recursive acronym. GNU is not Linux, not Unix. And he created the concept of putting together a completely free open code operating system. Now, this is all started and still by Richard. He'll correct you if you say anything otherwise. The free software movement. Unfortunately, free software is not the most marketable term when you're trying to turn any type of business model on it, but the concept is very sound. GNU carried on with the project, created an almost complete operating system by the 90s, but not quite enough into the kernel, and that was the herd system that they had together. And in 1991 in Helsinki, Linus came along and put together his little Just for Fun, which I think is the title of the book he has about the creation of the Linux kernel, and he based it on the standard x86 architecture.
So yeah, and didn't he say it's probably not going to be big?
Probably not going to be big, yeah. And he just wanted to have a Unix-like environment. Compiled in there, and he was using, I think it was Minix, and C compiler at the time, to put that together. And of course, he wrote the first solid, complete Linux kernel, which is pretty amazing. I mean, it's just blows you away when you think about how far we've come and all that, and it is just for fun little project, and, you know, who knew it would go where it went. So, he puts that together, and that's in, 1991, and from there, it really took off. And I have a couple samples of some of the code base on there. So by 1992, we called it version 0.96, 40,000 lines of code, 1,000 users. 1995, 250,000 lines of code, 500,000 users. 1997, version 2.1 of the kernel comes out, 800,000 lines of code, 3.5 million users.
Wow.
Fastest growing operating system in history. Microsoft doesn't have adoption rates that are in scale. And it's not that it's user adoption rates that we're counting here. Cause what really drove it was we had a collision. We had the internet become very popular. And it's been around for a long time, but the killer app for the internet was www. Everything had to have there. So they came up with the World Wide Web. At the same time, you had to serve up web pages. And the original web server was the NCSA, I think it was called, HTTP server, was dominant. And Apache, which started in 1995, was that first killer app for Linux. Microsoft completely missed the boat. Bill Gates didn't see this coming. He didn't, brilliant guy that missed the internet.
Well, didn't he say, or maybe you said this and I wasn't paying attention, that we'll never need more than 640 KB of RAM?
He said that, but it's also taken slightly out of context.
Oh, okay.
He actually has addressed it later in life, which has been kind of funny, of that famous clip of him saying that.
Right.
And going back to a little bit of history, which if you look for a documentary called Revolution OS, and it's about the history from the early beginnings of the free software movement, with some great interviews with Stallman and a lot of the other key players in there, the people from Mozilla and what made them do open source. But you can look at all that, and there's a scathing letter Bill Gates wrote, because he really didn't like the fact that people were giving away software. He thought people weren't going to make enough money, and the rights should be all held and closed. And closed source, and they rightfully say in there, is a monopoly on the support side of it. And that's a lot of what you see right now. When you have a closed source product, you can only have the people who wrote it support it. That's a very problematic thing. Because if they don't write good software and they create the monopoly on the market with the software, Microsoft, and then they choose not to support things very well, looking at you again, Microsoft, you don't have choices in the market. You can complain all you want about this whole Windows 10 push. They got a monopoly on the market. Everything was based on it software-wise, so you really can't just up and switch.
You know, not to hijack your conversation, but what I've noticed as far as Windows 10 goes now with on my machine that's running it is I'm now getting pop-ups, these pretty-looking pop-ups that tell me how great it's going to be for me to upgrade, and I just close them out. And
there is a tool now that a guy came out with that will disable those pop-ups.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm thinking of putting that in place.
Yeah, we use it all the time for customers. It's a great tool, and it just stops the annoyances. Because we've had some clients that do it, they, once again, back to the support in closed source software, because it was built on older versions of .NET, like the company that wrote their enterprise software, like you have a carpet company that has some enterprise software that measures carpet and does things. Well, the problem you run into is it doesn't work well with Windows 10. The company is very slow to get the updates out there because it's based on old Microsoft tools that are incompatible with 10. But of course, they're getting the pop-ups that they should upgrade to Windows 10, but their software won't work. So they can't run their business. So that, you know, the enterprise and business customers really have a need to stay, on a single platform for support reasons. I mean, they're like, well, we could probably figure Windows 10 out. We'd use it at home, but we can't use it in our business. So and you come to these, you know, walled gardens of support, all closed source. There's not any way to find someone else to update it, and there's not a lot of competition in it. So
exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
Causes a lot of problem. So the early growth of Linux, and a little trivia here. And I always thought this. It wasn't until I started reading on this that I realized I was wrong. I used to think Apache Server was a play on words of Apache Server because there were so many patches to it in early days. They actually did name it after an Indian tribe. They cleared the Apache Founder Foundation. They cleared it up.
They were a fierce tribe.
Right. They were a very fierce tribe. Mm-hmm. And that's what they said. They really wanted to kick some butt. That's why they named themselves after that.
Apaches.
It wasn't arbitrary.
Yeah. I think they're in the Arizona, New Mexico area.
Right, and if you look at their logo, it's a feather, like a Native American feather.
It doesn't mean we're all Linux people and hackers, and they always have
jokesters.
Jokesters and plays on words. I mean, come on, we started with a recursive acronym.
Yeah.
You know, and even Stallman would go around cracking people's passwords at MIT, and that was how he got people to stop using passwords altogether. He's got a whole other side philosophy of you shouldn't put passwords on anything, because you should rely on the greater good of the people. There's sometimes when I won't lie, there's...
Forget that.
Right.
So there's all kinds of little nuances that maybe, but yeah, nonetheless. Well,
and I can see I can see his theory behind it.
Yes.
But today, when everything's on the internet and there's things that can actually damage you and hurt you if somebody else sees it, then it just doesn't make sense anymore.
No. We'll move over to, you know, we watched Linux, great expansion. It went really fast. So that's, you know, so Linux right away makes its presence known. And of course, what the interesting business model was, the companies that started supporting Linux, Red Hat being one of the first public, VA Linux, they realized there was a market for
VA Linux,
big market for open source support. Now, they went to venture capital firms and trying to form these companies, and it was really difficult for them. And the reason why was they seen Microsoft as, what are you trying to do? You know, these guys own the server market, they own this. They just didn't see the value in it. It wasn't until the database companies really started getting involved that the venture capital companies would actually consider companies like Red Hat, because the database companies, we need something scalable and large. This internet thing is really taking off. People want things online, and we can't just have a bunch of flat files being served up off a server. We need dynamic, we need content. So the database companies started jumping on board, and which really rocketed some of the growth of Linux further in a lot of the code base. You know, and all this is why Linux has taken such a long time to see the desktop market, and a slow adoption of it, because it was all server side.
The year of the Linux desktop.
Yeah.
Every year 2016.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Well, that's always been repeated a lot.
And just talking about BSDs and the problem they had and what really prevented them from, because really, if they hadn't had the AT&T lawsuit, we might be running BSD systems.
Yeah, and that was part of the reason they had such, you know, it drove Linus to write the kernel because he didn't already have a kernel available, but a lot of the kernel development was stymied by the lawsuit with AT&T with the Berkeley Labs. So, you know, once again, we've got proprietary companies, you know, trying to stop development of community-based software. So that, you know, they're really driving it. One of the other big keys was they had to drop and this is where Stallman disagrees with people, they had to drop the word free software and they use it to open source development. Because it's not that the software is always free. It's the concept of that the code is compiled, perhaps even by a paid company, but then the source code is released with it. So that really represents what's going on here. Well, that's open source development. You know, these foundations, sometimes that release it, they're just giving away their code. So when you're putting all this together, you know, they had to come up with a better marketing term, because calling yourself a free software company and can you get in contacting a venture capital and asking for a stock to go, you want to give everything away for free and we should give you money so you can keep giving for them free, is a hard sell. So calling it open source, okay, maybe there's some marketing terms, but I like the term better myself. And I understand the concept of it.
Well, and it's also the idea that, that free, just because there's no cost in money doesn't mean that it's not worth anything.
Right.
And that's where a lot of people, especially corporations, have a problem with that.
They get a hard time understanding it. And in software, it's because it's more of an intangible. You can, it's not free. Free software is different than free beer or free candy. There is a, candy's a physical item. I can't just make a copy of it and hand Tony a piece of candy. Someone has to make it.
You have to 3D print it.
You can 3D print the candy.
Yeah.
But there's still materials needed. You know, software is copy paste. You can duplicate it. So it didn't devalue the product by doing that. So it's a very different concept. It's kind of like book publishing and things like that. So it's a different comparison. You can't compare it to the physical product world. You know, you just duplicate a project, copy a project, modify it, and redistribute it.
You know, one of my neighbors, he's an intellectual property attorney. I should talk to him.
He won't like me.
I don't know. I should talk to him about that. I'm going to just talk to him and just kind of get his...
Yeah, there's a lot of people because they spend so much time, and of course, that's what these IP attorneys are, is so much time, you know, securing all the intellectual property when there's a better concept and a better way to do it. Cory Doctorow is the current hero of the day for me for open sourcing everything. I mean, he gives away every one of his books and publications and makes a living. And we talked even in one of our last shows of that one artist who gives away his stuff. And I loved the way he titled his interview was, I give all my music away and I pay my bills in New York.
Hey, does he? Well, here's my question. Is there kind of a little stipulation that you just attribute it and say this came from so-and-so, or?
He does everything under Creative Commons, which I think,
asks
that you give original, you can't just copy Cory Doctorow's book and
claim
say it's yours.
Claim it as your own, yeah.
So there's a little bit of that in there.
Okay.
It would make sense. A big change in concept was when Eric Raymond publishes, what started as a paper, which is The Cathedral and the Bazaar, which it really was a introspective look at the changes made in the software world. And when things went to massive independent peer review over the internet, which is how the Linux kernel was developed, and he looked at all these lines of code and all the contributions, so many different developers who weren't sitting in the same room together and didn't have a clear leader, how this came. And the concepts are this. If you are in the camp of the cathedral, you have one person and a bunch of people listening to him who, from the top down, decides how a piece of software is going to be built, how the project's going to be done. Well, the bazaar, you think of a bazaar where it's driven by direct user interaction with a large base of people, and it's a bottom-up approach. You're fulfilling small user requests to shape a greater software. You look at Linux, that's what it is. It's a bazaar. Yeah. All these independent projects that come together as one operating system. And it's a really interesting different concept, and he's got a lot of concepts throughout there that breaks everything down. It's really fascinating to me how it's changed how we think about software development. It broke the rules. And, of course, that's what drove the whole Linux movement. Now, from there, we move into collaboration on grand scale that we're seeing right now. It's amazing. When you think about, how many people are involved in contributing all this, and the fact that it works. It's too many cooks in the kitchen is what we joke around about, but we have a whole lot of cooks building one hell of a kitchen.
Right.
And the recipe has been very successful. I mean, Linux has absolutely dominated a massive amount of the market on the server side and everything else.
Yeah, I think really what on the software development side is that there's a base, there's an organization of how those all go together. So...
Yeah.
How developers can add in without causing problems and
companies are seeing the value of contracting a programmer to write something and then give it back away. They give back the added code to the GPL. So they take a product, take a Linux product, they go, you know, we really like this, it really needs some horsepower behind it, and they're willing to pay the developer and then per the GPL release it back out there. You look at any of our phones built on GPL software, that includes Apple and Android. So a lot of this giving it away concept works, but you do it for the greater good and it comes back. It's not that people aren't making money. Google is based on open source and no problem, they're making money.
Exactly.
Facebook has done massive code contributions. Facebook has scaled on 1.3 billion people are logging into Facebook. They have the largest user base of any single product or platform. They built it on open source, but they ran into problems with the open source. No one ever made a website scale that big. So as they've developed everything, they've done and followed GPL and release it back to the community. As the community's looked at it and other companies have been able to build on that and scale to grand scale as well, that only helps the community and those code contributions come back again. So this back and forth is really driving a lot of innovation, is driving a lot of betterment of everything. So it's just, you know, huge for open source. Open source and security. Now, we talk a lot about security on this, and in the last month, the major big companies that have had security problems with their firewalls and things like that, they're not open source. We're finding backdoors hidden. We're finding stuff that just shouldn't be there. We don't know if this is government driven based on some of the Snowden files, but there's suspicion that it is. So there's a whole lot of trust issues and things like that in there. I'm a big fan of open source firewalls, of course. And this comes even to the consumer products. We've seen a lot of consumer routers that have had similar problems where you have open source solutions like the DDoRT, and through playing and reverse engineering, we found firewalls that had open ports, backdoors, TrendNet. What was something spelled backwards? It was like login spelled backwards. You could log into any TrendNet.
Really?
They had a backdoor in them. And it was one of those.
That's an interesting password idea.
Yeah.
And remember that?
It was basically the admin kind of oops and left the code in there is their assumption, but it left the back door into a bunch of this consumer products. Mm-hmm. And consumers don't know how to update their products, so there's a lot of problems with that. And you're talking about only like $35 routers and things like that. Just, it creates a whole series of issues. And once we start going to more and more open source, I see companies like Asus adopting this. Some of the companies are going, you know what? We're hardware companies and we're going to stop trying to be value add by putting firmware together. We can actually just build our chips and let these open source projects like the DDWRT project, create firmware for our routers. I love that concept.
I agree.
I think it's a great idea. You have easier to manage code base. You have one single code base. Well, there's been some forks. You got the Tomato Project, which is a fork of it. But once again, now we're seeing competition in the firmware market. So you can just be a device manufacturer and then you can use one of these open source products. And, I think you're getting an overall security. And on the corporate level, I use pfSense, and pfSense has built a great company. They sell hardware, they sell support and incident packages to help you out with configuring and setting up their firewalls. So now they've built a business model around it, but they give the source code away. You have plenty of review and good looking at it, and hopefully a lack of backdoors.
Right.
So, I mean, you said something with Cisco and might be have a latest one. These hard-coded passwords are just, that's insanity.
Yeah, I agree.
With Juniper and Fortinet. Am I saying it right?
Fortinet.
Fortinet.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I think there's a lot to be said about a lot of these projects being open-sourced. You look at the scalability of MySQL and some of the other databases, having that in there. So, moving on to where I think open source and government could really match up. So we do some work with some local municipalities, and I had a thought. One of the transitions we helped them with was buying the new software. They had it picked out because there's not a ton of these, but there's some municipal software out there. And what the municipal software is software for taxes, registrations, things that are general government functions. And it really made me think, going, all right, this city collects taxes. Well, all the cities in Michigan collect taxes. All the cities have a water bill to read because they provide city water. You start taking all these functions and you go, wait a minute, what if, crazy thought here, the government funded one time an open source project at the state level, and then every city got a copy of it through one open source project. Now, you paid the developers. This is still, a product goes on, but you then fund once, open source it. So, one, you've created a level of transparency so that we understand where some of our tax dollars are going. We understand the product and can be followed. Put it on GitHub. You maybe even find people who are willing to be code contributors to it. But every city essentially is replicating the same functions.
I'm sorry. Hold on, Mary.
Did you go to the right show?
Yes.
Yeah, I figured
that out.
Right. I'm sorry. No, yeah, and I agree, though, that what you're saying is because if the government is funding it and the citizens fund the government,
yes,
then why are we making why are the citizens paying multiple times to have the software
and
across multiple places?
And granted, there's competition in the market. If you look up like municipal tax collection software, there's different companies making different city softwares and they're selling it to every individual city. And I'm not against companies making money. I'm a business myself. But when I look at that from a standpoint of every city pays like $30,000-$40,000 for the software and then updates and licensing, and then the support was bad from this company. It was very difficult because we were moving them off an old AS400 system and doing transitioning for their property and tax records. It was kind of a mess. I didn't feel confident with the support. They had a lot of bugs that they had updates for, and I'm kind of thinking they had a huge list of cities that had already bought the software. I'm like, how is this not working? And we had a lot of feedback for them for they just misaligned some data. And of course, you're messing with people's tax records of paid and unpaid. And so, you know, the whole painful transition, I'm like, why isn't this just some open source project that doesn't base itself? Oh, by the way, they had to buy a bunch of Microsoft SQL licenses to go with it. Because the company sold the software and then they made them buy Microsoft SQL licenses to lay on top of the software.
Yeah.
So there was so many components. I'm like, it's really not that complicated in the big picture program. I mean, there's some math that goes in there. They have to calculate the millage rates and everything else. But guess what? You know, we can do that these days. Look at Facebook. You know,
exactly.
We have the technical competence to produce this type of product. So if it was a...
I like how you said that. Facebook and all this technical competence.
Yes.
And all people are doing is posting pictures of their pets and stuff.
Yes. If we can build a platform, if a platform we built that can have 1.3 billion people posting cat pictures, I'm pretty sure we can write some tax software at the government level, open source it, put it on GitHub. Now, there is some trends to do this. There's actually a civil CMS, which was a open source project I found that is a government had funded and open sourced a way to have a common CMS system for websites, because guess what? Almost every city has a city council meeting, meeting notes, and it follows a common structure. These common structures are laid out well. Then they have a common publishing method to get the information to the people via the web, which is truly an efficient form for releasing council notes. And when I look at what we did, like when we set up the website for the city, once again, we're just using Joomla was at the time what we built it on. And we have a whole series of platform, which other cities aren't using. So there's no consistency between neighboring cities for this. Go back to the open source idea. All the cities have the same functions with nuanced changes in their rules, but you open source these type of projects. You know, water billing, they all have to do it, do an open source project on that, and it would just make a whole lot more sense, which in my city, we just had a big incident with the billing software completely screwed up and messed up everybody's bills. Some people got huge bills, some people got no bills, and it turned out to be some bugs in the software that they were running.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Speaking of water, well, we were not going to speak too much about water.
Yeah, not too much.
Flint.
But you can go all the way to the state level and think about the DEQ and the Flint news that made national news. If you keep an open source system that really helped track it, and it does two things. You coincide this with transparency, and transparency is different than open source, but you keep the government transparent, and if you kept the software transparent that they're using, the two can go hand in hand together and give people a very clear view. So if you really want to dig in to the government, you can't. And seeing as my tax dollars paid for it, why shouldn't we understand the function, the process, the flow of who is involved in each step of the project? I think that's just a great idea. Moving on to a little bit in healthcare. Now, I've seen this as interesting. This is the GNU has a healthcare project. And that's where, at the national level, I think you could really see this. And you deal with some of this in your field, but it's the... what do they call that? The not ERM.
Medical records.
Yeah, the electronic
ERM.
ERM. The electronic EMR.
Or EMR,
EMR.
Yeah.
The electromedical records. Here's another one where there's a lot of companies competing to make software, but we're all human. Doctors have a common methodology that they follow when we need to this. You know, shots, blood pressure, statistics on ours. If you did this as an open source project, and you know, not the medical records, I'm not saying freedom here to release medical records, but if you made it easy where they had a common base system that easily transported across. Now, mm-hmm. this could be so much easier at the healthcare level. So instead of just, not just, you know, we have the concept of, oh, let's give everyone healthcare. Well, let's look at something a little bit different from the software side. If at the national level, everyone's mandated to use the same software, a giant open source project, doctors all have easy access to it. They have free access to it because the value proposition isn't trying to make money off selling them software, because this is killing all these small medical companies that have to buy this really expensive EMR software and compliance. Well, the government already has HIPAA compliance and layouts for compliance. Why not do the software, write the software in compliance? Everyone uses the same platform. Now, if I move across the state and I need another doctor, it becomes instantly portable for that medical file to be zipped up and imported into my other doctor's system, because they all mm-hmm. use the same platform. Makes it very simple and very easy. This is where I think open source could take things to the next level. We're seeing this in the private world. We're seeing open frameworks on PHP. We're seeing open frameworks in Python that are created. We look at WordPress. WordPress being such a common platform, look at what it's doing for web development. It's amazing. All these companies can create these incredibly diverse websites, and it's easy from a support standpoint. We make money building WordPress sites. We know the common platform. This concept that's working in private market, I think, could really be where open source and government could go hand in hand with each other. And I'm not talking too much out of my butt here, because I started really digging into Europe, and Europe is really following some of this.
You use the word butt and dig in the same sentence. Yeah. I'm just letting you know that.
So I started reading, and I'm not going to say every project is home. I could not read because they're in the foreign language, but this is the same things I'm talking about are being done in Europe right now. You know, they're using.
I think they seem to be much more advanced than we are
in some ways
in that area. And I think it's because the companies, the proprietary companies, are based over here.
Yes.
So I think that holds much sway over how the U.S. kind of positions itself.
It really does. And you know, when I look at some of these common things like this that are very common across the board, they're government issues, they're people issues. We publicly mm-hmm. funded them, and Europe seems to really be getting that, you know. And it's not like I'm talking socialism and things like that. And I like what Eric Raymond said when they said he's been called a socialist for his love of open source software. And he says, no. He goes, you know, you look at communism, you are forced to do it. I'm not forcing anyone. I'm giving away all the code I write because I want to. And that's anyone you meet in
freedom.
Open source. It's freedom. Anyone who writes open source tells you the same thing. I want to give my source code away. I want some peer review. I get feedback on it. We build it. And that's built the entire open source, you know, as we see it today. And it's such a growing community. And we're seeing Microsoft slowly lose their position. More and more people have Linux on their desktop and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my thoughts on, you know, open source, its importance. I could go into other different market segments, but the more we look at this, you know, safety and things like that, or cars, if they almost need to be mandated because of the problems we found with cars, and it's going to only get worse, they could kill people. With this whole Chrysler hack we talked about later last year, you know, someone thought to leave that open terminal inside there. And if it was open source or cars, guess what? They all function the same way. And having an open source braking system, so we all understand how, if you're going to make code to control my brakes, let's all take a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of Volkswagen, putting code in that changed the way the engine runs.
You're right.
Man, they've taken a huge hit.
They took a huge hit on it. It's costing them absolutely, you know,
yeah.
It's hard to say what's going to happen to the company like that, but it's back in the government interest and the people interest that we know the code that drives these things. It's literally a life in death situation when you deal with cars and software.
You know, and speaking of that, on the way down here this morning, there was a news report about Amazon, and it has to do with the Internet of Things. And these various appliances are going to be able to monitor how fast you're going through stuff and then just place reorders with Amazon.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think to myself, yeah, I mean, on the face of it, sounds convenient, but it just seems to me that somewhere I'm going to draw a line where I'm going to say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Some of the predictive intelligence that would help to say, you're probably going to order paper towels on Tuesday because we know you usually order them on the second Tuesday of each month.
Right.
Yeah. That's kind of interesting when you get into some of the predictive intelligence. But, you know, I like looking at some of these things, and, you know, mm-hmm. those come down to personal information choices. But when you look at the safety of things or just some of that, there can be times where predictive intelligence can help increase your safety, predict when you should slow down around a turn, you know, But it gets scary when you're throwing complete proprietary software and just hoping the company's on there. An article I actually picked up this morning was a girl whose pacemaker caused some problems for her and stopped her heart when it's supposed to keep her heart going. Mm. She has a rare medical condition that the pacemaker takes care of, but, and she's a programmer, but she doesn't have access to source code and she got pregnant. And pregnancy changes the way it was supposed to do, and it did not properly update to adapt to the heart changes that come with being pregnant. So it actually caused, worsened her problem, and she ended up in the hospital when it should have been fixing it.
You know, I think I remember seeing her at one of the Linux conventions. I want to say it was the Indiana Linux Fest when I went there years ago. But yeah, it was,
Yeah, and she had an article she published on, I'm trying to remember her name right now. I don't have the link here, but it comes back to, you think about all these medical devices are getting more and more automated to assist doctors, and you come to that question again. You know, if the source is closed, what happens? You know, we're making complete assumptions if there's a security flaw or anything. More eyes on the code. It's not that we've seen Heartbleed. We know that, you know, just because the code's open doesn't mean it automatically gets there. But we have no potential to observe the code on the other side versus at least the options there, and more eyes can start looking at it. And as these code becomes important, Heartbleed, SSL, look at the change that happened. Look at the funding. You know, SSL was a completely underfunded project, but used by everyone because no one thought about it. Now everyone thinks about it. It's an extremely well-funded project with a massive amount of developers. So that's kind of my thoughts on open source, why it matters, kind of where we came from, where we got there, and I'm really excited about where we're going with it.
That's very awesome.
Any closing thoughts, Mary? Tony?
Wow, that was pretty good. It was pretty interesting. I read an article, I think it was yesterday or today, just briefly because I was doing some other things, but they were talking about some of the big data vendors, or just some of the big data uses, and Hadoop and those kinds of things, and the gravitating toward open source that companies are doing because everyone is using it or is moving toward using it, and the fact that there's a good amount of support for it. And some of the other reasons go to the things that you were saying, you know, just as far as, you know, the standards and that type of thing. So.
Yeah. Well, there's a large open source projects for, open source farming. And what they're doing is they're using lots of geodata to measure rainfall and hydration levels in ground and predict patterns off of it. Yeah. Now, if you do this in a closed source versus an open source, everyone gets access to it, which also means everyone's willing to be a contributor. So you can massively gain the data faster and pull that back. So it's really interesting. And of course, what does that do? Better yield for crops, better yield for farmers, better food for us. So I'm all for good food.
I think that's really the strength in open source is the mass collaboration, you know, and it's not just your group of people in this one city that you can get data from. And you know, it's the whole, just because it's the open philosophy, you know, that everybody is contributing to it, and it helps out the greater good.
Yeah.
I also think how it's interesting that a lot of things that you know, the tools and software that's available really brings a level playing field to people that don't have the budget to buy a lot of software. You know, say, you know, I know a lot of people that have started their own computer repair business.
Yeah.
And there's so many people that wouldn't have been able to because they just don't have the budget to start a small business. But the tools are available free, so it's nice there. And that's also, it's a double-edged sword because that's where a lot of the, non-free, people or philosophy is that, open source is for small time stuff.
Right.
But it's not. And just as you were saying, there's the biggest networks, the biggest data centers in the world are now running all open source, and you know, Google, Facebook,
Twitter, eBay, all the big guys.
Yeah, it's Netflix. All in the background.
Netflix. Yeah.
Get my free BSD plug in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I mean, it's in these companies wouldn't have been possible with it. So what's more possible when we look at it from some other angles, like the government angle? And you know, what could we do if every government city that has water that they provide, which is probably most all of them in the U.S., and you can then start massively pooling the data and developing statistics.
Water and pooling. I like
water
that.
Water and pooling. Yeah. So you start putting all this together, and if they use the common platform, and we could eliminate, I just look at all the expense the city went through transitioning from one platform to another, not just the purchasing, but all the labor that was involved in getting all that switched over. I'm like, wow, government's all the same. You know, when you think about government being, they're not a business. They're a cookie cutter service provider that provides, although maybe similar, you know, the rule sets may be different, but the concept, what they provide in your
varying
city
versus degrees
my
of
city,
services.
Yeah.
You have to look at it city to city.
Yeah. Everything comes down to the execution of it. But when you start looking at it, they do the same thing. There's a water bill in every city. There's a tax bill in every city. There's a percentage of that tax bill that gets split off in, you know, for the schools.
I'm going to abruptly change lanes for a second. Yeah. Speaking of taxes and cities, do you know that Detroit is finally going to allow the online filing of tax returns or, you know, tax forms? Yes, I have. And unfortunately, they're not going to have direct deposit in place yet, but it's just amazing. You know, I have to pay a city income tax, a small, you know, like 1 or 2%, whatever it is, because I live in the city of Detroit, and all of my tax stuff was always filed electronically except for Detroit's. It had to be mailed in. Well, now I used to get a refund. I don't know if I will anymore, but... Yeah, so I'd have to mail it in, and then I would get a check back, and I'm thinking for a city that was teetering on bankruptcy, it fell into bankruptcy, and now it's out. That's an area that they should be just post-haste, advancing, you know, as far as technology goes, just to save money, because that's, you're talking, you know, postage and all that kind of stuff, just the handling and processing.
Right. Well, you know, even in keeping track and auditing, you know, what has and has not happened with the tax system. You know, because that's what I heard, one of the largest downfalls was that people weren't paying taxes, and they just never followed up with it, probably because it was a gigantic paper headache to do it.
It just took too much manpower.
Yeah, and also some companies, if they had employees working who lived in Detroit working outside of it and vice versa, they were not withholding the Detroit tax.
Right.
And these people, if they lived outside of Detroit, they weren't paying it.
Yeah.
And now they're going to go after them because the state's...
Detroit is such a weird rule. I don't know if this works outside of Detroit, but if you, just so our listeners know, if you work in Detroit, you pay a Detroit tax just because you work in Detroit, even though you don't live
in
Detroit.
For the privilege of working in Detroit.
Yeah.
It's actually a fairly common thing for cities that have income tax...
I didn't know they did
whatever
that
taxes. Because where I was growing up, Battle Creek, there's a Battle Creek tax also, income tax.
I think it might be something in Michigan that gets done. Because I don't recall it in Minneapolis. But see, the thing of it is, in Minneapolis, the state taxes are higher. So I think it's just really, it's kind of a bucket. It just depends on how it's collected.
It's per the city. You know, I mean, I work, my taxes come out of Troy, but there's no Troy income tax. So it's whatever the city, if they want to charge
higher
it.
Property taxes in those.
Probably.
That's probably right.
Well, and the problem though is that it's taxation without representation. Because me not being a resident of Detroit cannot say I don't want to pay Detroit taxes.
Yeah, there are a lot of people
that
say that.
Or I
want to
change it. Right. Well, yeah, no, but either way, when I was growing up, you know, I didn't live in the city of Battle Creek, so I couldn't say, you know, or not just say, I don't want to pay it, but say, why is it this rate? You know, we should change it. Things like that.
Yeah. So they just said, here's some cereal, kid. Get going.
And when you look at, if you look at Florida and Nevada, I believe
it's
neither
Kellogg's
one of them
and Battle Creek.
Florida and Nevada don't have income tax at all because they're tourist states.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's why I never set foot in Florida.
Oh.
I am not going to contribute to the tax base and that really they,
the
you
Disney
take a
tax.
Look. Oh my gosh! Yeah, you try to drive. You drive any place? They got toll roads.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
But they're smooth.
I don't care.
The beaches
There's
are nice.
Alligators and hurricanes.
Yeah. There's alligators and hurricanes.
So I just don't. I try to avoid Florida, and I try to avoid. There's a couple places. Yeah, when they don't, I think you know what? I'm going to stay in my home state, and it's got a wealth of natural resources. I'll take fresh water over salty beaches any day.
Yes, I do like fresh water better.
Now, anybody who's listening to this who lives in Florida, I'm half kidding.
I'm still not paying your taxes.
But, I don't want to pay, I don't want to be on the hook for their taxes.
Yeah.
No. Okay.
All right.
Wow, we should have had a rant show. There was my rant. That just kind of popped right out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we could do that entire tech rant. I mean, there's so many reasons to rant, you know, security done wrong, support done wrong.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah.
The status of support. You know, that's something, you know, the monopoly on support topic.
KD Plasma done wrong.
You know, with the Thomson Reuters. They bought up all these accounting softwares, and now they are the primary provider of accounting software for business accounting by accounting firms.
No one from my old company knows I do this, I don't think, so then I'll be hearing it. But so go ahead. What are you going to say?
Anytime there's a release, because all the accounting companies that we have that we support all use the software, every one of them now. Like, they all avoided using it as long as they could, and they don't have a choice now because, you know, the newest version has been, the company that a lot of them all use have been bought, so now everything's moved to this, oh my gosh, bad package. The updates break something every time. Their support is hard to get a hold of. They're everything's difficult about them. And I'm like, there's not an option. They've created
really,
a monopoly
in
the market.
That's really too bad. Because, you know, having been in the inside of that company, there's a lot of, well, I wasn't in the tax and accounting division. I was in the legal division, but there's a lot of, you know, hardworking people in there and everything. You know, and I was one of those people, and I always worked really hard for my customers. So
and
it's just disappointing to hear that.
And it's, you know, with QuickBooks being another one, pretty much every small business runs on QuickBooks. There's very, very little competition in that market.
Yeah.
Even from myself, I'm working on open sourcing all, and only because the code's so bad is the only reason I have it. I'm going to give away my entire point of sale, but it's not geared for any point of sale. It's geared for small computer businesses. But there's not a lot of easy or alternative softwares out there for QuickBooks, and there's really very little on the open source market. I mean, as much as I like the KMI Money program, it's not easy for me to, it's not near as easy as QuickBooks is to show someone how to do something in. You know, even the video I did was tedious and, you know, trying to publish more information for them on this in the documentation, but there's not anything that's as intuitive, simple as QuickBooks and complete for a small business product.
Well, see, and there's a drawback of open source software. From that perspective, because when you take a look at who's developing it, the team that's developing it, how many donations have, I think you can develop something for the passion of it, and you're going to throw a lot of time and effort into it, but then you've got a finite amount of time and effort.
Right.
And if you're better compensated, whatever that compensation model is, by doing something else, I think there's a tendency to drift over toward that.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think it's important to donate to projects that you like.
Oh, yeah.
And that you use. Because then that just, hopefully fosters a sense of commitment on the part of those developers to do more and to move it forward faster.
As a business, I frequently donate to any projects that we use internally, when they have donations or the buy me beer buttons and things like that. I frequently donate to those.
Yeah. So.
All right.
Okay. Well, here we kind of started off on a really good pay, and we ended on rants.
Right.
I guess that's it. Is that right?
I think so.
Wow. All right.
All right. So thank you for listening. You have been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This was episode 178.
Fresh looks. Oh, I forgot the rest of it. Tom?
Fresh looks. Oh, yeah. Why open source matters.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
I'll have a new brain next time, I promise.
Me too.
And this is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
And Tom Lawrence. Sorry.
See you next time.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.
Hi, folks. This is Chatter. Gay Wisher Honky Magoo 5150 and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduke to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
Linux Luddites is a show where we try out all the latest free and open source software and then decide we like the old stuff better.
More than just news and releases, we check out a wide range of Linux distros, cover your feedback, talk about obscure command line programs, discuss burning issues over a pint, and much, much more. So join me, Paddy,
and me, Joe, every 2 weeks for news, reviews, comment, and generally being grumpy at LinuxLuddites.com.
Linux Luddites, because not all change is progress.
Open source, Linux, computers, electronics, science, and amateur radio. We cover it all. Who are we? We are Linux in the Ham Shack, the podcast that brings you and your technology together with the power of software freedom. Drop us in your favorite podcatcher or join us every other Tuesday night for the interactive live show. Visit lhspodcast.info for all the details, news, and information. We are Linux in the Ham Shack, and we want to open your mind.
The Linux Link Tech Show, live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast. On the web, www.tllts.org. By email, techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC channel, thelinuxlink.net, port 6667/techshow. And Flying Rich is so hot.